Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye's summer studio with Adam McQueen, Ian Hislop and Matt Muir. We're here to discuss the events of the last week since the last edition of the magazine came out, and we thought we'd start off with one which has been all over the news. It's the story of the Crewkerne Gazette. And the person or people behind it. So this is an online comedy account, which is mostly consisting of AI videos, and the people behind it have been in the news, but it turns out we're already familiar with them, aren't we, Matt?
We are. So I got interested in the Crewkerne Gazette in November of, sort of during the summer last year, and mainly because I kept on seeing these videos kind of floating around and various elements of the right-wing press saying laudatory things about, as you point out, this new frontier of satire. And I was just curious as to what was going on, who the people behind it were, and questions of that ilk. And I dropped them a line in November asking if they'd be willing to answer some questions. And they responded saying they would be perfectly happy to answer questions, but they were very keen on preserving their anonymity because we live in a climate that is dangerous for free speech in Britain, as I'm sure we can all attest to.
Private Eye, you know, anonymous. Fair enough.
You're absolutely fine to be anonymous if you so desire. But sure. I was curious as to the motivation behind it and also fundamentally how they were funding a lot of this because, you know, making AI videos isn't free. And the better they are, the more they cost. You know, the tokens cost money, etc. And so I just wanted to get a little bit of insight into that. And over the course of these conversations, I got the vague impression there was something a little bit odd about the whole operation. I couldn't necessarily pinpoint exactly why, but the man behind the account who styled himself Crewkerne Man and who appeared in various videos wearing a sort of Make America Great Again style cap with a very heavy beard and aviator sunglasses, often AI-generated videos themselves. He had spoken about having spent time in America, getting in with a crypto crowd, and I was getting curious as to what his beliefs were and why exactly, despite the fact that he said that he was very much in terms of in favour of satire and making fun of everybody, why specifically all of the videos that he put out were kind of pro-reform and Tories and very much knocking anybody on the left. And I'm just curious as to what all that was about. Anyway, digging around, and then over Christmas, we completely coincidentally got a tip-off from somebody who lived in Crewkerne and saying that, oh, by the way, this bloke's a convicted Nazi. Adam, I believe, has the full rap sheet over there.
Yeah, it's quite a long one. It involved, you can read, actually, if you just Google this, the sentencing remarks from the last time he was sent to prison on the 8th of December 2016 by Mr. Justice Spencer. That was for the cruel campaign of vile racist abuse against Luciana Berger, the Labour MP. But it was also on top of six offences of sending malicious communications and offence of harassment, all arising from false and hateful allegations against innocent members of the public that they were paedophiles. And there was an incident as well where he effectively made up a story about a pub which was banning members of the armed forces, and that resulted in that pub having to close and then death threats and arson threats being made against that pub. It was just sort of fantasy in his head. Now, we should probably say at this point that Joshua Bonehill Payne says he's now a reformed character and he greatly regrets all of this and he has done his time in prison. But you actually put a question directly to him, didn't you, in December?
I did, yeah. So we got this tip-off and I sent the person to whom I'd been corresponding, the self-styled Crewkerne man who has said that he'd been communicating with me throughout this time, are you Joshua Bonehill Payne? Because we have received reports that you are. And he said that he categorically denied that the person I was corresponding with was Joshua Bonehill Payne, which obviously wasn't true or hadn't been true previously.
I hate to correct you on your own question. What you actually asked him, because this is going to be important, was we have heard that the person behind the Crewkerne Gazette is one Joshua Bonehill Payne, previously convicted of incitement to racial hatred and racially aggravated harassment. But you were conversing with the Crewkerne man. You asked if the person behind the website, who identified as the Crewkerne man,
yes, and he said that he categorically denied that he was that person. And so, therefore, when we published the story, having myself gone down to Crewkerne and received multiple confirmation from drunk people in pubs late one evening, the person behind these videos very much was the same man that had been convicted twice of racially aggravated hatred, we printed the story, at which point we were subject to what our legal counsel described as a wonderful bit of ChatGPT work. So, yeah, this was a letter suggesting that the I had fundamentally misrepresented the facts of the case, because the person who had been corresponding with me was not, in fact, Joshua Bonehill Payne. It was the other person behind the Crewkerne Gazette.
Also
account.
Anonymous.
Also anonymous.
And offering no name or any evidence that this person ever existed.
But therefore, that made our whole story completely unviable, and therefore we owed him damages. I think we went back to him with a polite response, if I remember correctly. I think it wasn't Arkell versus Prestram.
It was a moderate version.
Yeah, exactly. I thought
of that. It was not a convincing legal letter.
It was not a convincing legal letter. And fundamentally speaking, I think what's been interesting about the whole story and the subsequent he's going to become a counsellor, or no, he's not going to become a counsellor, is that there is very little about the man in my correspondence with him that struck me as convincing. The arguments as to why he was doing satire were not convincing. His explanation as to the rationale for the satirical direction he was taking was not convincing. His subsequent video that he made when he knew he was about to be unmasked, and he put a video on his YouTube channel saying, who is the Crewkerne man, and voluntarily unmasking himself in what, and I encourage readers to look this up because it's quite interesting, what's a very, very, very bizarre AI-generated Q&A between an AI version of himself and an AI interlocutor. God knows why he chose to do that, but anyway, he did. It features multiple instances of him talking about how he was de-radicalized in prison and how he underwent a variety of different Home Office mandated courses and has gone on to do training and workshops to speak about his own de-radicalization journey, which, let's be clear, is a good and positive thing. In the video that he put up explaining this, he illustrated these with completely AI-generated images of him standing in front of a lectern, reading... It misspelt the word anti-Semitism. It was that poor of an AI thing. It used the logo of an organisation which doesn't appear to exist anywhere. I contacted the Home Office about this, citing that specific organisation that was in this video. Never heard of it. We have never done any work with them. I'm not suggesting that he hasn't done these courses. In fact, he's demonstrated proof of having certificates from Prevent. The certificates are from e-learning courses, which are an introduction to Prevent. There's a lot of stuff here that I just find curious, I think it's probably fair to say.
Yes, and our first response was, if you question a man and his first response is to send you a legal letter, then maybe being an elected representative of the people in which you're supposedly accountable to the general public is not a good idea for you, because even rehabilitated, the first thing you want to do is shut down any questions about yourself. And that isn't good for local government or for a wider role such as he now has.
I completely
agree. We're in an extraordinary situation where we can kind of say, putting aside the neo-Nazism, this man is still massively unsuitable for public office, aren't we? But that's not apparently the conclusion that Kemi Badenoch has got to.
Well, this is the thing, because Kemi Badenoch has a different opinion, I think, of all of us. I think all of us acknowledge that councillors do a good and important job. Kemi Badenoch said he would just be sorting out parking, looking at bins. never mind the fact that this is what most people care about in their most immediate lives, and it's a sign of where the government is working, where the actual bins have been taken away and emptied. You know, that is, that's the point. You know, that's what people get most angry about. So she has decided that, no, the bar for being a councillor is different to being an MP.
She specifically said, I have much higher threshold for what it takes to be a Conservative MP, but apparently not for a special advisor on rehabilitation and race issues, which is what he's now been appointed to.
And the interest, well, what there are lots of interesting aspects here, but the Times piece, which was about the Crewkerne Gazette saying how good the videos were from February, I'm sure the Times were not aware of any of the prison history and the neo-Nazi stuff, but they pointed out that he just had a Christmas card from Kemi Badenoch.
Yeah.
So she clearly, I think, has questions to answer about her opinions on rehabilitation, because they seem to be absolutely all over the place. Her main charge was that what people don't like is, I'm quoting here, hypocrisy where politicians ask for selective forgiveness for their own side while demanding tougher rules for their opponents. We should be tough enough to stand by our beliefs, even when they are politically inconvenient, wise enough to recognise rehabilitation, and consistent enough to apply the same principles to friend and foe. But I think the problem with this is that she has quite clearly shown a bit of favouritism towards someone on the Christmas card list, or if you remember the story of Frank Hester, who made some really, really appalling racist comments about Diane Abbott, who had also donated 10 million quid to the Tories. When that story came up, she said, look, let's not go around looking for racism everywhere. The important thing is what's in someone's heart. Whatever. It's got no internal logic to it, unfortunately.
I mean, I think it's also worth pointing out that Kemi Badenoch is a terribly, horribly online human being. Mm. I would be willing to bet thinks that the output of the Crewkerne Gazette is exactly the sort of fast-paced satirical communications appealing to young online people that the Conservative Party ought to be doing more of. And I mean, obviously, I don't want to suggest that the popularity of that channel and its content may have had any bearing on her and the party's decision to bring this man back into the fold again, but I'm also not saying that.
Making a passionate and earnest and committed case for rehabilitation is fine, but rehabilitation straight into public office, slightly different. No one is saying, never give this man a job again. He shouldn't be allowed to go around telling people that anti-Semitism is a bad thing. All for all that. Do we have to have him as an official at a local level? Probably not. If then he resigns under pressure, not saying, everyone's got this all wrong, I really am a better human being, I would like to help. He resigns under pressure. You then appoint him as an advisor at a higher level. I mean, there are lots of jobs he could do, I am sure. Does it have to be to do with the offences he committed? Long term, they are quite serious, and there are a lot of them, and they do involve violence. Is there not a job centre? I mean, does it have to be the Conservative Party?
I'm afraid it's the last resort for the totally unemployable. That's the problem.
This just seems like, I mean, you think all those many, many people who are lined up to be Conservative candidates in the next set of local elections and who haven't yet had to step down, what are they going to make of that? It's a hell of a kick in the teeth from all the people who are actually going to be out and shoving the leaflets through boxes and campaigning for you, isn't it? It's such an extraordinary way to treat your own supporters.
So if you go back and look at the videos that the Crewkerne Gazette has put out, and which unfortunately I have done, it's only been going for a year. It started producing these AI-generated satirical pieces in about May of 2025. And over the course of last summer, it was featured lots and lots and lots of very pro-Nigel Farage videos, making Nigel Farage look very cool. Lots of stop-the-boats rhetoric and narrative. Mm-hmm. Lots of stuff about corruption under Labour and how Keir Starmer was weak and ineffectual. And then basically since about February, there has been a fairly, fairly big shift towards pro-Kemi Badenoch, pro-conservatism. But apparently he was also being courted last year by Reform, because he had previously applied to them to be a councillor and they got back in touch with him saying, we've got spaces. He apparently went through vetting, and in November of last year,
Reform vetting.
It's a big thing.
Yeah.
So,
but Kemi Badenoch did say that the vetting procedure that the other parties were using, the Green Party, Reform Party, was very, very poor and there was a higher standard. So it doesn't look like it, does it?
I mean, there are questions to be asked. I suppose the thing that I find particularly interesting about this in terms of extremism, now, let's be very, very clear, anti-Semitism is a terrible thing and it is good and proper that it be stood up to and stamped out. What I do find curious, though, is that throughout all of this, obviously he served jail time for incitement to racial hatred and anti-Semitism. He's also been convicted twice and served community service for other racially aggregated offences. So Adam mentioned the full story about the pub banning service people. Mm. The coda to that story was that the pub allegedly banned service people because they didn't want to offend migrants. That was specifically...
Oh, that's the version he was putting out.
That was the version that he was putting out. This man has a long and storied track record of being an all-purposes troll, and specifically has also directed quite a lot of fairly vile racism and misinformation towards the Muslim community. And again, after he was unmasked, he did a surprisingly long and surprisingly in-depth interview with the Times of Israel, which, by the way, also called him Britain's premier satirist. Sorry, Ian. where, as evidence of his increasingly philo-Semitic views, he posited that a lot of the evidence that has been cited by organisations such as the UN for Israeli war crimes in Gaza was the result of Hamas manufacturing evidence using artificial intelligence. And he would know because he's an AI specialist. Mm. Again, I would question whether or not that statements of that ilk make someone suitable to be an elected councillor.
And on a general issue of rehabilitation, Kemi Badenoch is unforgiving of those who have suggested that net zero might eventually be a good idea. They're not allowed in the party. They're not to
disreputable
be
figures such as Grant Shapps, who was in the cabinet until the last election, and Gavin Barwell as well, Theresa May's top advisor. They're now not welcome in the Conservative fold because they don't agree with things that Kemi does.
For those of us with a slightly longer memory, you think of Profumo. His rehabilitation was doing charity work in the East End for about four decades, and he was eventually allowed back. There was some long-term evidence that he regretted his actions and he wanted to be a better person. I think it's quite quick to allow someone to run for public office after crimes of this magnitude.
I think that is not unfair. There are also some remarkable inconsistencies in some of the accounts that he's given over the course of the past week about his rehabilitative journey. There was one interview, he was quoted in the BBC as saying that it was the murder of Joe Cox that first set him on the path to de-radicalisation because he realised that, you know, fomenting hate had potentially very serious consequences. Joe Cox was murdered in the summer of 2016. He was then tried for the Luciana Berger offences and sentenced in December of 2016, during which sentencing the judge remarked upon him smirking throughout the trial. And Luciana Berger herself has said that he directed an anti-Semitic gesture towards the public gallery during that trial, which suggests that maybe that Damascene moment post the murder of Joe Cox possibly wasn't necessarily strictly accurate, or that he has misremembered the chronology. There you go, that's a fair interpretation.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
So, section 2 of the podcast, Ian has regenerated as Helen. Hello, Helen. Helen Lewis. Helen, you've seen the internet in the last week or so.
I stared into the dark heart of the internet.
You've actually been to one of the physical bits of the internet. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, since we last spoke, I've been in Michigan and Wisconsin, which are ground zero for the resistance to data centres. Essentially, particularly the big AI companies and cloud computer companies need rack after rack of server and these very high spec chips. And they have to be single-storey buildings, which means that the campuses are massive. The one that I went to in eastern Michigan is 250 acres. Which is huge, over 1 million square feet when it's finished.
That's a
kind of campus. There's a couple of, I think, there's three main buildings. But it's just these huge sites. Luckily, America's very big, but otherwise there'd be real problems.
All the insights on this podcast now. America is very big, people.
Yeah, I was mentioning this before.
I want to check, I want to break it down even more. When I asked ChatGPT to make me a dreadful video,
yes.
Is this the building where it gets made?
Really, yes. So your request will probably get sent to the one. This right. particular one is being used for Oracle, which is Larry Ellison's company, and then OpenAI, Sam Altman's company. So yeah, when you ask ChatGPT, you know, how magnet work, then it will go and then it will come back to you here.
Right.
And it will use also about as much energy as one nuclear reactor can supply. That's the other thing about these. The water usage of them used to be a huge problem. It's become a smaller problem. But the energy usage is huge. The demand on the grid. Some of these are using like 10% of the grid demand in the place where they currently are. So they're these huge infrastructure projects. They've become a huge issue in the midterm elections, which are coming up in November, because essentially about 70% of people are against them. NIMBYism is a very potent force in politics, as we previously discussed, and there are lots of farmers who basically say, I don't want a possibly noisy, not very many jobs, very energy-draining eyesore on my land. And then there's this other thing going on too, which is these are, as you say, the first physical manifestation of the modern internet. And it turns out that a lot of people don't like the modern internet, and they certainly don't like the big men who are behind the modern internet. And this is a kind of physical way of saying, no, I don't like it. I don't trust you. You know, and so the resistance to them has been huge. A couple of states have already declared moratoriums. One candidate for governor in Wisconsin is running on a moratorium. And even Vivek Ramaswamy, who you may remember, he was going to be the other half of Doge until Elon Musk went, mine,
He lasted about a week, didn't he?
He was almost truss-like in his...
Was he the first thing that Elon Musk decided the government could do without the expense of?
He's running for governor of Ohio as a Republican, and he's now come to this thing saying, actually, you know, these data centres, until they give everyone around them free electricity, we should have a moratorium on them. It's very difficult now in lots of states where they're being built. About 1,400 built in the US last year.
Yeah, there's a story this morning I saw that there are, I think, 500 bans now currently in operation across different states in the US, different counties. Deciding unilaterally that they're going to try and put limits on the construction, whether banning them outright or stipulating that there have to be certain kickbacks.
It's hard to work out sometimes whether the numbers are large or small. As in, 1,400 of them being built sounds like an enormous number, but in terms of overall electricity usage, I think it's going to be about 1.5%. But then in America, it could be going from 5% of electricity to 10% by 2030, which suddenly does sound like quite a substantial number.
For something that didn't functionally exist...
Yeah.
5 years ago. It's extraordinary. Like, the footprint of these is enormous. And the fact is that essentially the seven big tech companies have been, with their capital expenditure on these, that's all those stock market prices you've seen, that's been driven by this. They are spending billions, I mean, actually possibly maybe even trillions on this in the next couple of years.
I think one of the things that's important to remember is that we don't know how much energy these things use. Like, we simply don't, because none of these companies have a duty to sell us. There are figures buried in projections. So, for example, Google has said that it is unlikely to be able to meet environmental commitments that it made a decade ago because year on year its energy consumption has gone up by 38%. Now, they don't have to specify that that's because of AI or how much of that, but, you know, the likelihood is, etc.
But it's not because of making those extra Google of the Day things.
No, it's all about that.
Right. Okay.
Every time you click on the funny logo and you see the nice animation, it screws, so it kills a tree.
Right.
But, and again, the same thing for water. So there are no official statements for how much water these things require, because obviously the technology changes and it's improving and it's less than it used to be. But there were court documents filed in Virginia earlier this year between Google and this particular county for the potential construction of a set non-specified number of data centers, which projected water usage of between 2 and 8 million gallons a day of drinking water.
And this is a huge deal in America, particularly the sort of western parts of America, which are basically desert. I mean, there are legal battles that have been going on for decades over whether California is stealing Nevada's water.
And the Colorado River level has been falling and falling and falling. Water politics is a huge deal in America. But you're right, and they're spread out often across more permissive states or more farm-based states. But essentially, there have been lots of pockets of local resistance. And because it's this America, this is playing out through lawsuits, which is good news for journalists because it means there are lots of documents to look at. The New York Times had a great story from Louisiana, and this actually reminded me of like a big steroidal American version of Teesside, the great private eye story of Richard Brooks, because Facebook's parent company was asking that local officials not only for a tax break to be smuggled through in a bill that was about fiber optic cables, but also making local officials sign non-disclosure agreements. Because essentially the bet from all of these tech companies, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, on this, is that there aren't going to be that many winners, right?
Yeah.
And they're particularly worried about that China will be the winner. So everybody is racing to build as much compute as they can, as quickly as they can, and trying to just ram things through. Which is funny to me, because I went and thought, I wonder if this is happening in Britain. And all of our ones are like, we're going to have a £10 billion one that's going to start building next year. And you're going to be finished by 2030, and you're like, who knows if there'll even be an internet or a human race by then? That's the American calculation, right? Build it now.
Zuckerberg's point is interesting. He published an open letter about his vision for the future of AI overnight, which is basically him saying, no, it's all going to be open source because he doesn't think that Meta is going to win the frontier model battle. And so now he's going, well, no, we're going to make it open to everyone because this is a good that has to accrue to humanity.
I don't want to compete with OpenAI and Anthropic because I think they'll win.
Yes, exactly.
Why don't we all just play nicely together?
But there was a large swathe of that, which is about data centers, and he speaks about them as a public good that we should all embrace, and posits that in the future they'll be great for people because local areas, whether it be counties or states in the US, will be able to extract tax revenue from tech companies, so that'll make it okay. And he also commits that by 2030, all of Meta's data centers will put more water back into the system than it will extract, which I'm guessing is going to be via the purchasing of water credits, which are probably going to be like carbon credits, which, as we all know, are definitely not bollocks.
I mean, technically, they could do that by just being neutral and then, like, Mark Zuckerberg having a whittle in a local river. that's a free one out there for you, Mark, if you want to take that.
Sorry, going on about the tax revenue. I mean, Facebook famously, they're so keen to pay more tax, aren't they? They're constantly lobbying the government to pay more tax.
It's property taxes. Yeah. That's the way that lots of these things work. So the one I was reporting on in Michigan has pledged a load of upfront money for the local fire department, for example, $7 million for that. But also they reckon we'll be paying, even with the very healthy tax break they've been after, about $100 million a year in property taxes. What's interesting to me about it is that people don't believe that money will ever come.
Right.
It's not like they've just gone, well, that sounds a lot of money, yes, please.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, well, hang on a minute, you wouldn't be offering us that much money unless you were about to do something really shady. Yeah. And just this low level of institutional trust that they'll ever see the money, or if something goes wrong, as you say, with the water table, that they have any recourse. So it has become this very physical manifestations of people's feeling that there are these huge, almost supranational organisations that are basically unaccountable to anybody.
And what they also don't have is the usual payoff with this kind of thing, which is employment locally, is it? Because, I mean, if you get an enormous Amazon warehouse or a mine or something else that's going to blight your landscape, you do get an awful lot of local jobs. And that's not the case with these. I mean, they're pretty much self-sustaining once they're up and running, aren't they?
They talk a lot about the construction jobs that will be... and that's true. The one in Michigan said it's claiming thousands of construction jobs. And then they say about 450 jobs. But it's very hard to see long-term... Given that the problem is that the AI industry has been ruined by its own rhetoric, which was like, jobs, you won't need jobs, there won't be any jobs, we'll all just be robots. So understandably, people think, well, maybe you'll have like a night watchman and, you know, someone like dusting. But it's not going to be highly skilled, well-paid jobs. You know, it's interesting. Some places have accepted them. There's a town in Maine that has basically ruined the Democratic governor's plan for a moratorium because they want one in their town. And the reason they want one is because there used to be a paper mill there that exploded accidentally.
Right.
And this is now going to be redeveloped as an AI data centre. But that's another part of the story, that you're talking about bits of America that deindustrialized in ways, particularly in the Midwest, that were really painful. There was a car plant that employed loads of people and that was gone. And they wonder whether or not, is this the phoenix rising from the flames, or is this just another thing that's going to come along and then leave us in the lurch again? So I just think it's become this real rallying cry in quite a lot of states, actually.
Would anyone like to put the bull case for these things?
I mean, okay, so a bull case. If you listen to Google, the reason that we need the AI and the reason we don't have to worry about the environmental impact of the AI is because the environmental problem is going to be solved by
The AI.
The AI.
Oh, wonderful.
The other bull case is that your pension, if you have one, has gone up extraordinarily on the back of the US stock market, and that these companies, the tech firms, are really the only big growth area.
Although it's also entirely possible that a good 2/3 of them are going to fall very, very, very flat.
It does feel very much like the dot-com bubble of 2000, doesn't
it? It's interesting. I've gone back and forth on AI as a bubble. I don't know if you have. And I think it's both incredibly useful and there are bits of it that are very bubbly.
I think there are two things that are true in parallel here. Firstly, that the technology is transformative. It does work and it is going to change the world and it's going to disrupt it in ways that we can't possibly foresee. And also that it's not going away. And secondly, that a lot of the financing around it is dodgy as all hell, and a lot of it is going to fall apart, leaving a lot of very, very burnt fingers significantly in investment and pension funds, potentially.
Yes.
Isn't this part of what happened with the dot-com bubble? A lot of people lost a lot of money. We all still use the internet now, you know. Mm.
The dot-com bubble was built on technology that was fundamentally good. It's just that people got overexcited about its utility and mischaracterized it. And that's kind of, to a certain extent, parallel to what is happening now. The difference being that one might argue that AI is significant and transformative in ways far beyond that which the internet was.
Well, there we go. If it's coming to the UK, the good news is the UK has plenty of water to spare at the moment. So that's at least one worry we can take off the table. Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Right, now let's come to the final story of this week. Weirdly, it slightly echoes the first story we did today about the Crewkerne Gazette, but this one is about Jason Arday, who was Cambridge's youngest black professor when he was appointed in 2023, has just resigned over accusations of plagiarism and plenty more besides. This has become an enormous story. Partly because it's August.
It's a rollicking good yarn, though, as well. Like, I just think
got some extraordinary detail in there, hasn't
okay.
it?
You were the moment that Carter Ruck entered the equation, I feel your little ears pricked up.
Gloriously, at last, we had Carter Ruck and Jolly and Mormon, the Good Law Project, on the same side, which is the point at which I thought, oh dear.
Avengers assemble. But also because it fits a narrative that is very popular, particularly on the right, that academic standards have somehow been sacrificed on the altar of woke and, you know, DEI, this quite American phrase that's been creeping in here, diversity, equity and inclusion. So that is what's given the story such play. I mean, normally a Cambridge professor resigning over plagiarism would be interesting. It would get maybe a day's headlines, but then not much more than that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that has turbocharged this story is the fact that all his work is in the sociology of education, and a lot of it is sort of semi-autoethnography, by which I mean he goes and interviews other black professors and people about their experiences of racism. So there is a feeling, which I think is probably justified in this case, that in this kind of post-awakening time, Cambridge was very keen to have somebody researching these issues, and they maybe didn't ask as hard questions as they should have done about whether or not the research really stood up. There's also the complication that really the person who broke this was a blogger called Nathan Koffness, who is very big into the hereditarian account of IQ and racial differences. And he has a quote, here we go. "In a meritocracy, Harvard faculty would be recruited from the best of the best students, which means the number of black professors would approach 0%. Blacks would disappear from almost all high-profile positions outside sports and entertainment." So when that's the guy having a go at the black professor, a lot of people are, like, just switch their brains off because they go, oh, okay, I see what's happening.
And Koffness has already been kicked out of Cambridge University, hasn't he, for expressing
views
like that? Yeah.
Through a tribune, he's now in Ghent, yeah. So I think there was a lot of people were just assuming that this was an unfair attack on a black academic. Now, as it turns out, the guy is... I mean, I've sort of...
Plagiarism and the academic stuff is the least interesting bit of it, isn't it?
I mean, the stuff in the autobiography is just amazing.
Running 600 miles in 6 days on a broken leg? That was one of them, wasn't it?
600 miles in 6 days. He then said, actually, I had a rest day in between them. Because people had pointed out this would make him one of the greatest endurance athletes of our age.
It's the sort of thing you might have heard about, isn't it?
He ran a kind of Eddie Izzard-style level of marathons in which he claimed that at some point he'd fractured his leg and nonetheless he kept on running. Which, again, people who run marathons are obviously mad, in my view. Mostly my husband here. But doing so on a... Yeah, there was, you know, he claimed he had epilepsy, he claimed he had a brain tumour, he claimed in a proposal for the book he had testicular cancer. He was either the unluckiest man in the world, or he'd made it all up.
And it was extraordinary because the pitch for the book carried a set of extraordinary and amazing stories. And then the book... manuscript, when it arrived, carried a totally different set of extraordinary stories in many cases, didn't it? I mean, there were whole bits that were missing.
And yeah. But the thing that's interesting to me is, first of all, the fact that it was a real lesson in where on what basis people make their judgments about whether a story is true or not, which is often about the messenger as much as the message. And the second was that this, you know, one of our Paul Foote Award nominees this year was the Salt Path investigation by The Observer. Yet another sign that actually you can write any old bollocks in a memoir. And that was interesting. We talked about the Salt Path at the time. You know, Moth in that, he's claimed to have a really unpleasant degenerative disease, which nonetheless...
Corticobasal degeneration, yeah.
Right, which nonetheless, a decade later, has not died from. Mm. But that's the kind of thing you can't... How many people have really got the cojones to go, is your terminal illness actually that bad? And I think that's the case that's happened with him. There is an enormous taboo on questioning people's very painful personal experiences. And there must have been a million stories you've done in the eye about people like child abuse victims, where people do not want to say, at this point, has this detail crossed into the land of fiction? Like Carl Beach, for example.
Well, Carl Beach was originally known as Nick. He was the anonymous, at that point, person who made a load of claims through a very dodgy news agency called Exaro, which was run by a very strange man called Mark Watts. It was in the wake of kind of Jimmy Savile and all of those kind of things coming tumbling out of various dark cupboards. And there was a kind of public mood that was ready to accept the idea of VI paedophiles, was what they were called at the time.
It's a great place.
And Carl Beach gave them the most VI of paedophiles. I mean, Edward Heath was in there, Harvey Proctor was in there, Lord Field Marshal Bramall, Leon Britton, all sorts of names which he seemed to have plucked from various corners of the internet. And extraordinary claims, not just about sexual abuse, or sort of routine sexual abuse of children, but murders to order and people being castrated and strangled and extraordinary things. None of which were true at all, and actually turned out to be the complete fantasies of Carl Beach, who himself went to prison for possession of child abuse material himself. There is this extraordinary thing sometimes where claims become sort of too extraordinary to check. In that case, one of the basic things which BBC Newsnight managed to knock down was one of Carl Beach's claims was that a child had been deliberately run over in Kingston-on-Thames as revenge for speaking out against this paedophile ring. And they did the basic checks of going back the year and I think 2 years to either side of when he claimed this had happened to find out whether any small children had been killed in road accidents in Kingston-on-Thames. No, nothing on the record. So that's the sort of basic kind of like grunt work you have to do. And we do that as journalists, but I don't think publishers of non-fiction put the hours in on maybe they will have to start doing so now. I don't know.
What about universities? What about Cambridge University in this case? Do they have a responsibility to check out these claims?
What's really fascinating is that he got his PhD from Liverpool John Moores University, and now it looks as though there are some very similar segments in that to things that have previously been published. And I'm kind of surprised. Every undergraduate essay is run through a program called Turn It In, right? A plagiarism checker. Now you'd imagine that everybody's running everything through Pangram, which is the most well-known of the AI checker tools. But they don't seem to have done that. They issued a statement saying we had investigated it confidentially and his PhD still stands. The moment that really kind of tipped over the edge was that Cambridge said that they were doing a formal investigation. And that's the point at which he released via the Good Law Project an extraordinary statement that basically admitted absolutely nothing, but said these attacks have been so vile that I'm withdrawing from public life, which to me just says that he doesn't have a great deal of insight into his condition, as it were.
I think it's possible that multiple things can be true, that Jason Ardet is a strange, possibly fantastical individual with an odd sense of his own life and his own achievements that doesn't necessarily match up to accepted reality. And also that certain sections of the press have had an absolute field day with this and have used it to run an agenda that is coincidentally and conveniently very close to the one that they like to run about non-white people for the rest of the year as well, even when it's not true. August.
Yeah, we had this with the police recently.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that the police are somehow institutionally hostile to white people was a narrative earlier on. And you know, there are plenty of examples where that is simply not the case.
Yes. Right, and it's not purely, this isn't like a purely left-wing sin. It's just always interesting to me to ask what are the narratives that are very hard to question in any society. You mentioned Carl Beach. The podcast a couple of times ago, we were talking about Rupert Lowe's independent grooming gang inquiry, which, you know, contained alongside things that I'm sure absolutely did happen, extremely fantastical snuff elements that could have been checked by saying, did someone die at this time in this place?
Yeah.
So the problem is, again, it's like, what do people want to believe? What's the narrative that people have already accepted? And then the facts are always secondary. Someone once described to me that journalism is the war of facts against narrative. Mm. And I think that is something that you should really always bear in mind.
There does appear to have been some very basic stuff, again, in the case of Jason Ardet, that Cambridge could have checked at the time of employing him. It was sort of professorships that were claimed and links to other institutions as well, which would seem like your sort of pretty basic due diligence that you might pick up the phone to someone if you were giving them a professorship.
I think everybody always assumes that someone else will have checked.
Mm.
And I think that's the kind of thing that we have to sort of fight against.
Well, you also don't naturally, as a human being, as a journalist or as an academic or anything, assume that someone is telling you a massive great whopper every time they speak to you, do you? We are sort of programmed to accept that.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever checked for your degree certificates? Has anyone ever asked you to provide them?
I don't even know if I've got the certificate still. I mean, I wouldn't know where to look for it.
I did, because when I apply for my American visa, you have to go and find them. So I had to be like, do I remember really what I did for my A-levels?
I've got one, because proudly, like my first ever published byline in journalism, McQueen is spelt wrong. So
great.
But there's loads of this stuff about, isn't there? Do you remember Ian Duncan Smith claimed a university degree
and he'd done a
short course? Jeffrey Archer.
Well, the absolute classic is Jeffrey Archer, who, if you just say things confidently enough, you can get away with. He went to a different school to the one he implied to everyone who went to, two different universities he sort of claimed to have attended as a student when he hadn't. My favourite one, Jeffrey Archer, was when he was elected as an MP at 29 for Louth in 1969. He went round claiming that he was the youngest MP in the Commons in the very same year that Bernadette Devlin had very, very famously been elected as an MP in Northern Ireland at the age of 21. And it was just people just wrote it down and carried on. And he sustained an entire career on that, right up until the point he was jailed for perjury.
Right up until, that's the thing.
Mohammed Fayyad was a man who couldn't be honest about anything. He couldn't, his name, his age, the source of his fortune, absolutely anything, and was using that as a way of kind of blathering with that, and legal threats as well, which again we come back to Jason Ardet immediately calling in Carter Rugg. It was certainly something that Jeffrey Archer was prone to throughout his political career. Fayyad was using it as cover for the most egregiously disgusting behaviour, you know, rapes and sexual assaults, as well as all the other criminality he was responsible for.
I think you're right. I think there has been an agenda behind it, but there are also things that the right has raised here that we should acknowledge were correct and true. One of which is the fact that a journalist tried to look into him and was warned off by the police.
Yeah.
And like, what are the police doing? So he put his right to reply in, essentially, and the police were like, please stop harassing this man. Which is just...
And it was the Times Higher Educational Supplement. You know, it wasn't kind of racist sweetly or anything. Right.
Stormfront or the National Enquirer. Yeah. No. You know, not to be like pleading in service of journalism, but the world is often quite hostile to the being told that the emperor has no clothes, and there are often very good reasons not to point out the emperor has no clothes, and I think this story has suggested some of the dynamics that underlie that.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Page 94. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another one. Until then, why not ascertain the truth for this week?
good.
Yeah. The Truth in Private Eye. Go to your local newsstand or go to private-eye.co.uk and get a subscription. Well, from all of us, Professor McQueen.
Thank you.
Professor Lewis. Viscount Muir.
Viscount. Commodore.
Vice Admiral Hislop. And of course, Earl Hill.
Supreme ruler of the universe. Matt Hill, every Concordia.
Matt Hill, senior producer. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now. Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.